world.
This is Charlotte Tux. I'm Mike Collins. 50 years ago today, on May 20th, 1963, about 65 people marched from Johnson C. Smith University to the Mecklenburg County Courthouse and back without incident. They held a 5-minute or a 15-minute rally at the courthouse, which was closed due to the MECDEC Day celebrations, demanding an end to segregation. Dr. Reginald Hawkins spoke from the courthouse steps, saying, "We are not going to cooperate anymore with segregation. Segregation is a sin, and we cannot compromise with this sin." This seemingly benign event in the history of the civil rights movement spoke volumes about Charlotte, led to the integration of our restaurants, hotels, and movie theaters, and eventually, in a way, to the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This moment in our history is being commemorated today and through the next several weeks in several ways, including a conversation this hour with a number of people who either participated in those historic events or who know a lot about them. Reginald Hawkins Abdullah Salim Jr. is the son of Reginald Hawkins Jr. He marched alongside his father in 1963 as a teenager, experienced the bombing of his family's home in 1965, and became the first black youth to integrate Charlotte's YMCA. He went on to launch the black student movement at UNC Chapel Hill and is now a Maryland attorney specializing in immigration law. He's back in Charlotte to observe a part of history in which he participated. Thank you for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Also with us is Jack Claiborne, who covered the civil rights movement of the 1960s as a longtime reporter and eventually editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Jack's brother, Slug, features prominently in the story we're going to talk about today. Good morning and welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you, Tom. Mike,
you're welcome. Willie Ratchford, you can call me anything. It doesn't make any difference. Willie Ratchford, and you soon will. Willie Ratchford is the executive director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee, which had its genesis during that period of our history. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Tom.
It's Mike.
Good morning, Mike.
Tom Collins is a great drink, though, I'll tell you that. And Maria Hanlon is executive director of Mecklenburg Ministries, which has continued the kind of work which started with the eat-ins you're about to hear about. She established or helped establish a program called Friday Friends to break bread with someone from another race as a means of breaking down fear and establishing friendships through a meal. And she was also instrumental in organizing the events commemorating the 1963 march and sit-ins that are coming up this week and next. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike.
Welcome. Take us back. Who organized this march, the civil rights march, which ended up in the eat-ins, which ended up in today's commemoration? Who organized all this back in 1963?
Well, if that question is directed to me, but before I get started, I'd like to say, in the name of the Creator, the most merciful, the most beneficent, may peace and blessings of the Lord be upon us all today. In 1963, my father, who was a founding member of Mecklenburg Organization on Political Affairs, decided that it was time to institute some action in order to bring about change in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area. There had been demonstrations prior with the sit-ins and things of that nature with the students from Greensboro as well as Johnson C. Smith. And those students were readily acceptable to the changing atmosphere that was needed in order to bring about positive change. And those positive changes were, of course, opening up the tablecloth restaurants, which heretofore had not changed since the sit-ins. They weren't integrated. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, there were many, many things that were going on in the civil rights movement since Brown versus Board of Education, and even before that. A lot of people don't know. But specifically in Charlotte, Brown versus Board of Education, there were test cases in which my father and other right-minded individuals attempted to bring about change. And as things metamorphed, the school integration in 57 with Dorothy Counts and the overturning of the Pearsall Plan and trying to bring about some understanding of racial equality, These things came about in 63, in which on May 20th, in which the students, the populace, and everyone else right-minded at that time said that it's been 100 years of non-change. The change had gotten repressive after the Civil War, and things weren't getting any better. And that was a time when people were willing to make active sacrifices in order to bring about change, and that's what happened.
And I said that you were a teenager in the 60s, and you did march with your father. Did you march with him that morning?
That morning, I did not.
Okay.
I marched with him at Howard Johnson's in 62. We went out on voter registration drives and a lot of things. Where I was that particular day, I don't know.
Okay.
I have talked to one student, one teacher who was around at that time, and he mentioned that it was they were at school, so I assumed that I was at school on that
day. I want to talk to you about your father, because he didn't start this in 1962 or 63. He was an activist for integration well before that, in the 1950s, when it wasn't fashionable. Fashionable is not the right word, but it wasn't the thing to do. It was the anti-thing to do. And he's kind of, and I hate to say this, but he's kind of faded into the mists of history. He's not the figure that he deserves to be, at least not in Charlotte. So tell me about him.
Well, my father grew up in Beaufort, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
As he grew up as a teenager, he was a bell diver for Duke University Marine Lab. And he wanted to go into science. His mother was a Native American, American Indian. His father was African American.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up learning and understanding that education and hard work and sacrifices was the key to freeing the oppression and the circumstances which existed during that time when it came to African Americans and people of color. He went on to Johnson C. Smith University, which was a Duke endowed school, through the urging of Dr. Alexander Hume at Duke University, who he studied under. He did scientific research while he was there, and he classified marine life that had not been known up until that time. He came to John C. Smith, and while he was at Smith, he was accepted in medical school at Howard University as a dentist. And during that time, we had the young pioneers in the Civil Rights Movement who felt that it was time to bring about changes simply because through the law, through the NAACP, to other organizations at that time, because there were no changes that were taking place.
You know, you don't generally associate bravery with dentists. You associate with bravery with sitting in the dentist's chair.
He got his dental degree and his bachelor's from John C. Smith in 48. And he went on to get his Master's of Divinity.
But the point I was going to make is that for somebody to be in the civil rights movement in the 1950s and to kind of shake the trees, as it were, and upset the status quo is a pretty brave thing. Jack, you want to talk?
Yeah, I wanted to say that Reggie Hawkins, when he was a student at Johnson C. Smith, played on their football team.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up across the street from Memorial Stadium, my brother Slug and I used to go and watched Johnson C. Smith play, and Reggie Hawkins played blocking back in a single wing. The blocking back was the guy who went through the line ahead of the ball carrier to clear the way and knock the opposition down, and that was sort of a metaphor for Dr. Hawkins' career.
And the word bravery or courage has come up already in this conversation, and that's one of the things that Maria Hanlon, I know that you want to spotlight this week. This took a great deal of courage for these people, not just in this city, but elsewhere. I know you grew up in Montgomery, Alabama, so you had your own share of courageous individuals down there trying to change things.
Well, and I think it's important to remember we have our stereotypes of Alabama and of other places and people, but how many courageous people it took. And the blacks and white leaders in Charlotte 50 years ago, that was some courage, or chutzpah, as our Jewish brothers and sisters would say. And I think we're not just looking back to say, rah-rah Charlotte, we did it positively and peacefully. We're saying, what courage do we need today to be the city, the issues that we need to address? But I know in Montgomery, growing up with parents that never went to college, my mom and dad, but my mom, the active one, very involved in civil rights, very involved in having blacks come to our church, to our house, but also speaking out in church and teaching the youth about racism as a sin, segregation as a sin, and why have good white Christian folks, and this was in 1970, 2 years after King's assassination, she was preaching, even though she never went to college, about racism and segregation and what is the responsibility of folks of faith to stand up, to have the courage to stand up, no matter how unpopular it is.
Mr. Salim mentioned the name of Dorothy Counts. Jack Claiborne, Dorothy Counts, for people who don't know, was the first African-American woman to integrate a high school in Charlotte. Is that correct?
She was one of four.
Okay.
There were integrations at Harding High, Central High, Alexander Graham Junior High, and Piedmont. The other three integrations went fairly smoothly and well, but there was a white protest about Dorothy Counts going to Harding High, and that was the story that made national headlines, and Dorothy Counts' picture with being spat on by white students went all over the country and all over the world and helped to chasten Charlotte, and I think created the kind of fears that civic and political leaders had in mind as the 1960s drew on, and they did not want to have that image of Charlotte cast around the country.
Because that was in 1957.
57.
And this march took place in 1963. The eat-ins we're about to talk about took place in 1963. That was the year that the governor of the state of Alabama, George Wallace, stood someplace on the stairway someplace.
Capital.
And said, yes, segregation today, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever. He was cheered for that statement. Birmingham shocked the nation that year with showering protesters or marchers, peaceful marchers, with high-power water hoses, which really kind of turned the tide toward this because in national psyche because it was on television and it shocked people. We, on the other hand, prided ourselves on making our transition in civil rights completely as peaceful as we could make it, unlike Birmingham and other cities in the South. Why were we able to do that? Jack and Willie. Willie, go ahead.
I think that we were able to do that, if I might go back to what Maria was mentioning earlier, and it really has to do with courage. What they did in Alabama, that it was easy to do, you know, to continue racism and hatred and treat other human beings as inhuman, as not being human, just based upon our history. That was really easy to do. But it took a lot of courage to, especially for African Americans, to put literally their lives on the line to say that this is wrong and something needs to change. So I think that we did it differently from Alabama and other cities, or Birmingham and other cities, because of the courage that existed in this community with Dr. Hawkins and Dorothy Counts and many countless others who just had the courage to say, this is wrong, let's do something different.
Willie Ratchford is the executive director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee. We'll come back with him, Maria Hanlon, Jack Claiborne, and Reginald Hawkins Abdullah Salim in just a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Isiola at Linville Golf Club, featuring local fresh cuisine, a Donald Ross Championship golf course, fly fishing, and spa, located off the Blue Ridge Parkway. Information at isiola.com. And Henderson Properties, providing real estate sales and property management throughout the Charlotte region for 20 years. HendersonProperties.com. Well, if ever coyotes come to most people's minds, it's usually because they've watched an old Western or maybe a Roadrunner cartoon in which Wile E. Coyote is playing pranks. We don't think of coyotes in Charlotte roaming neighborhood streets, occasionally picking off small animals and pets, but they are. And we're going to talk about what is becoming evidently an increasing problem, not just in outlying suburbia, but here closer to the inner city. Coyotes in Charlotte, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, many states are moving to end lifetime alimony, the biggest change to American divorce in decades. Debate over the purpose of alimony and how it's awarded.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 and WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about some historic events that occurred this day and throughout the next several weeks, 50 years ago in 1963. Today, May 20th, a group of 65 people from Johnson C. Smith marched from the university to the courthouse to protest segregation. And shortly thereafter, there were a series of eat-ins, not sit-ins, we're going to call them eat-ins, at area restaurants among African-Americans and white civic leaders. We'll talk about that in a second as well with Reginald Hawkins, Abdullah Salim Jr., the son of Reginald Hawkins, who spoke at that original march on this day in 1963. He's now an attorney in Maryland. Jack Claiborne is a reporter and editorialist for the Charlotte Observer. Willie Ratchford, executive director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee, and Maria Hanlon, executive director, soon to be ex-executive director of Mecklenburg Ministry. She's on her way to Greensboro to do something else with her life. Let's go back to this question about why Charlotte was successfully able to keep the transition to integration as peaceful as it did. It was not without hiccups, but it was nothing like Selma. It was nothing like Montgomery, Alabama. And Willie Ratchford brought up courage, but wasn't it more than that? It had to have been more than that.
Charlotte is a business city. It has always been a business city from when it was the crossroads of two Indian trading paths. But in the late 1950s, Charlotte wanted very much to have an international trade festival created next door to the old Coliseum out on Independence Boulevard. And they invited the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, to come and speak. And Rusk said, "I cannot come and speak to a segregated audience. You've got to integrate your Chamber of Commerce, and you've got to create an integrated hotel for me to stay in." So Charlotte set about to do that in order to have this happen. And that sort of told the business community in the early 1960s that this is the way the world was going.
But what about places like Birmingham, Alabama? That was a business city, big industry in Birmingham. What about Selma? They had obviously Chamber of Commerce and business interests. Why did they see it differently, or why did we see it differently from the way they saw things?
I think fear has a lot to do with it, and there was so much fear in Alabama where the integration had happened so forcefully. But I think also the faith community here in Charlotte. I mean, you had Carlisle Marney, who was standing up with Slug Claiborne in that meeting to say, let's do this. You had Reverend Dr. John Cunningham, president of Davidson College, who said, this is a faith issue, and mm-hmm. we must do this out of faith. The right thing to do is to realize that our black brothers and sisters are as human and deserving of as many rights as we have.
This was in 1963, this march we're talking about today, and the civil rights movement continued for many, many years. It continues today, really, but it continued in earnest through the 1960s. And it was a bumpy road. It wasn't an easy road. What did your father say about this? I mean, just because these eat-ins occurred in 1963, he obviously knew it wasn't over. The struggle wasn't over.
Of course he did. My father was an ordained minister. He was not only a dentist, he was an ordained minister. He was an ardent human rights advocate. And that's what we have to understand. Civil rights are those rights that are given by a government because the people demand human rights, and so it's codified into a body of law domestically. But human rights transcends domestic law, and this he understood by being a theologian. And in order to bring about those rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is indigenous of this region, which goes back to the Declaration of Mecklenburg, which goes back to these anti-slavery stands of Queen Charlotte, which brought about the spirit of these Scotch-Irish that settled this area, who were fleeing from oppression, who were fleeing from affliction and fleeing from slavery as it existed in Europe at that time, which was an indentured system. Mm-hmm. It was the pioneering spirit, the spirit of the seminaries in Charlotte, like Johnson C. Smith, like Davison College, like other theology seminaries, that people start to understand that this is a universal human issue, not just a local issue, not just the issue that's permeated for the last 300, 400 years. This is an issue that needed to be resolved now, because if it set to fester any longer, it could bring about rebellion in this country, which nobody was for.
Television news, local television news, was in its infancy in 1963. Everything had to be done on film. It took hours for the film to be developed, so there would just be readers. If there was a newscast, it was probably 15 minutes long. So the big kahuna here is the Charlotte Observer and the old Charlotte News. What was the Charlotte Observer and the Charlotte News take on these events, both in the news pages and on the editorial pages?
Well, the Observer and the News were both very progressive newspapers and had been for many years. The Charlotte News was a much more liberal paper than the Observer for years up until the 1960s. But the take was that this was a national uprising that was headed towards a huge national change. Pete McKnight had been editor of the Observer. Prior to that, he had run the Southern Education Reporting Service, which was created after the Brown decision by the Supreme Court integrating the schools. That association was to keep Southern newspapers informed about what was happening in the South. And Pete was very much a progressive, and he had written editorials before 1960 saying that the handwriting is on the wall. Mm-hmm. We know where this is all going, and we need to prepare for it. And the Observer and the News reflected that in most of their editorials.
I have an article here which I believe is from the Observer, although it doesn't appear to be credited as such. Let me just check on the other page here. Could be from the Observer, could be from the... It's from the Observer. I'm going to read a portion of this article about the march that took place, and I'd like to get your take on this. It says, city police cars and plain clothesmen in unmarked cars saturated the Trade Street parade route. On several occasions, police held up traffic at intersection as the Negroes moved along. City Manager William Veter and Police Chief John S. Hoard stayed close to the demonstrators in an unmarked car. The marchers attracted relatively little attention as they tramped across the city. On the sidewalk in front of Uncle Charlie's place at 1033 West Trade, six white checkers players and kibitzers hardly looked up as the singing Negroes brushed by. As the procession wound out of sight, one old man looked up and growled, "They ought to arrest every damn one of them." The game continued without interruption. In front of the old post office, as an old Negro man watched the marchers walk by and shook his head, "Punks, that's all they are. Punks," he muttered disgustedly. Noting that Johnson C. Smith is a church college, he added, "That's who's raising hell all over the country. Church people." That's an African-American saying that. At the courthouse ceremony, two elderly white women moved up and stood with the Negro crowd. Afterwards, they declined to give their names. "We're very proud to be identified with this group," said one, "but we're concerned about crank calls."
Well, that story was written by James K. Batten.
Okay.
Who was later the editor of the Observer and later president of Night Newspapers. that story reflects what I think was the basic Charlotte response to that march. Mm-hmm. Why are these people marching? I think the story reflects both white and black mystery about why are the people stirring up trouble. We don't want trouble. I think
isn't that always the case when the status quo is
it is exactly
being shaken?
Exactly.
People who benefit from the status quo don't understand why we need to do anything about
it. That's right. And that's why it takes courage to make things happen. And
well, I'm leaving town so I can be a little more radical. I just hope the church will raise some hell today, because that's what we need to do. And you have got a lot of clergy who are going to march today that are in Raleigh for Moral Mondays, where they are saying, no, we cannot take away Medicaid benefits from the poor or voting rights. And I think the church of the past did more to envision the future and have the courage to work for it. And that's what I want to say to the faith community of all faiths in Charlotte, is we need to have the courage to say, what are the issues in education and in immigration and in orientation that we need to come together and address?
We'll talk about that for a second, because a lot of people in the faith community and a lot of people in the African-American community supported Amendment 1, which constitutionally enshrined a ban against same-sex marriage last election. And they didn't see that as a civil rights issue. They saw it more as a moral issue. They saw it as stopping sin in some way. How do you paint that differently from the faith perspective and from the African-American perspective?
Well, it's a great question. And for me, I will do it from the faith perspective. All of our holy books say love God and love one another. And you can't love one another if you diss or demonize. So if you say those Muslims or those immigrants or those gays, you are automatically going against faith and loving your neighbor and getting to know them. Now, you may not agree with them, but it seems like basic human rights is fundamental to liberty and justice for all. And if we say blacks are fully human and gays are fully human and immigrants are fully human, it really should make people of faith and no faith look deep inside to say, who am I to say that they are less human than I am, or to demonize or dismiss them?
Mm-hmm. I think that it also points to something that's just fundamentally wrong with people who might view it that way. You have people who want to pick and choose what sins are sins, and those things that they might do, then that's different. I also want to go back to the article that you quoted a minute ago. I think that article pretty much speaks to the long-term impact of race and racism on individuals in this country. Many blacks suffer through what we call internalized oppression, and that's when we use racial rhetoric, a racial thinking to subjugate ourselves. And I think that the gentleman who was the black gentleman that you mentioned who was against the marches, perfect example of internalized racism. The impact upon whites is that the racism causes whites to just render black people totally invisible. So for the Checkers players who didn't even look up, these were invisible people. They didn't even notice that they were there, and they didn't care, because that's the impact that race and racism over a long haul has had on us.
I also want to say, though, that story was not hidden in the newspaper. That story was played on the very front page of the paper with a big picture of the march. Mm-hmm. The Observer was not hiding that story. It was putting it out there and making sure that everybody understood that something significant had happened that day.
And the day they chose – I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just want to say that slavery is a system, chattel slavery, which was unique of any other system that was known in history. Mm-hmm. Africans were stripped from their homeland. They were sent to the Caribbean islands for what they call slave breaking, if they were fortunate enough to make it that far. Prior to that, armies fought against slavers to the last man, able-bodied man, which left it open for women, children, and old men in order to make the marches to the sea where they were kept as captives. All of this was a part of slave breaking. In other words, voiding a person of his mind, lobotomizing his past, lobotomizing who he was, taken away from him his identity, so that by the time those slaves that were controllable were sent into America, or those who they thought were controllable were sent into America here and were able to mix tribes and mix languages and things of that nature, so that there was a system where a caste system even among African Americans was there. And so you had your field hand who was out there toiling, getting beat. You had your plantation slave, and et cetera. So there was a system set up that way. This gentleman that you mentioned was a person who was an example of a person whose mind was completely stripped from his soul. Mm-hmm. And this was not voluntary. This was something that was pushed on him after 400 years of slavery, 300 years of slavery, of 300 years of forced indoctrination, 300 years and 400 years of non-education, being unable to read or write, to reclaim his true identity, to have pride in himself and pride in his people and those who he was the descendant of. Truly, even today, the African American is the only tribe on the face of the earth, and I use that word tribe because there is a uniqueness about us. We have a history that was unique of anyone else on the face of this earth. We can trace our history to Africa, but all mankind can also do that through the mitochondrial DNA of the mother, which shows that all of us came from Africa. But African Americans are unique. We are the only lost tribe. We are the true lost tribe because we have no idea who we were before we were brought here, other than we were told that we came from an uncivilized region, which was a total, total untruth.
This march that took place on May 20th, 1963, took place on a specific day for a specific reason. It's MECDEC Day. It's the day of the Mecklenburg Declaration, when in 1775, it is alleged that people from Mecklenburg County signed a Declaration of Independence that is the precursor to the one in Philadelphia that we all know about. There is some question about whether or not that really occurred, but this march took place for a very specific reason on that day, to point out the inequity that all men are created equal, but not if you have a caste system, segregation, correct?
That's correct. That is 100% correct.
Why did they think that doing it on MECDEC Day would be any more effective or have any more impact than doing it on the 4th of July, which is what everybody knows to be Independence Day?
Well, the Mecklenburg County was the turn and the focal point of the Revolutionary War, as far as I'm concerned. Cornwallis said he came here and he was stung by hornets, because this was a hornet's nest of rebellion. Cowpens, Kings Mountain, Guilford Courthouse, we trapped him at Yorktown. We're not given credit for who we are. This is a place of pioneering spirit. This is a place where Mecklenburg County declared its independence. And then 1 year later, America did so also. But in that declaration that came after Mecklenburg, it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these rights are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the white community's involvement in the integration of Charlotte and what I think is pretty remarkable, the mayor at the time, Stan Brookshire's involvement in all of this. Stay with us. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, introducing the all-new redesigned 2014 Forester, providing more legroom and rear cargo space, a CVT transmission, and up to 32 miles per gallon. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And Mr. Rogers Windows, a local family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at MrRogersWindows.com. LifeTime.com. Many states are moving to end lifetime alimony, the biggest change to American divorce in decades. Diane and her guests talk about the purpose of alimony, how it is awarded, and whether it should be changed, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show. By the way, you can find information about our guests' events today and through the next several weeks commemorating the anniversary of the eat-ins and the march, the desegregation march in Charlotte, at our website at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
Nothing from the Queen City is sacred when Charlotte Squawks comes to the Booth Playhouse. This irreverent musical review takes aim at everything from pop culture and sports to airports and politics. WFAE is hosting an invited dress rehearsal on Thursday evening, June 6th at 8. Find out how you can join us at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the march that took place in this city on May 20th, 1963, 50 years ago today, which led to eat-ins around the area at area restaurants and the integration of the white tablecloth, so to speak, restaurants. With Reginald Hawkins, Abdullah Salim Jr., the son of Reginald Hawkins, who led that march from Johnson C. Smith to the courthouse on this day 50 years ago. He's a Maryland attorney today. Jack Claiborne is a reporter, a former reporter and editorialist for the Charlotte Observer. Willie Ratchford is executive director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee, and Maria Hanlon, executive director of Mecklenburg Ministries. This is where it gets kind of difficult for me because I wasn't here then. But the march elicited these eat-ins at restaurants. Jack, your brother Slug was instrumental in this, but why did the march lead to eat-ins?
Because Reginald Hawkins at the courthouse signaled to the community at large that we're tired of gradualism, we're tired of tokenism. This march is peaceful, we're singing and happy and clapping. The next march we have will not be so happy and accommodating. We'll be much more militant in the future. And the mayor, Stan Brookshire, heard that. He didn't hear it. He read it in the newspaper and said, I've got to do something. He called the Chamber of Commerce directors together and said, look, all of these things that are happening in these southern cities, we do not want that to happen here. We must do something. Stan Brookshire and Reginald Hawkins had crossed paths many times previously. Reginald Hawkins was a factor in the desegregation for the International Trade Festival 2 years earlier. Anyway, the mayor got the Chamber of Commerce directors together, and they agreed that they would get the hotels to desegregate, and then they would ask the restaurant owners to come. And the restaurant owners gathered in the city club, a private meeting, and said to the mayor, we cannot desegregate, and to desegregate would ruin our businesses, our white customers would go elsewhere, and we cannot do that. My brother, Slugger, who had just opened a cafeteria, his first...
Barclays.
Yep, Barclays Cafeteria, the first of 14 restaurants he was to run. And he said, wait a minute, let's use the sit-in tactics to make this happen. Slugger was not an ideologue. He was an old football quarterback, and he knew strategy. And so he said, hey, how do we solve this problem? This problem we can solve with strategy, and
now
he did it.
Your brother went on to become a restaurant legend in this city, owned a number of establishments, some very big establishments, before the liquor by the drink became the norm. And so restaurant business was very difficult for those people who were in it before then. But he was a young guy. He wasn't the legend that he would come to be when he made this decision, when he stood up and said, wait a minute. So how do you explain that? How do you explain somebody being willing to put at risk this new effort, this new cafeteria, which could have gone crashing down around his head had this gone awry? How do you explain that? Why would he do that?
Because Slugger was a people person. He did not think in terms of segregation or desegregation or any kind of ideology. He looked at it as, hey, this is a problem that we have with people. And Slug understood people. He had worked with white people and black people most of his life. And he just suggested, hey, this is a way we can get this done. If each of you directors will agree to call up your counterpart in the black community and invite them to lunch, we can break down the barrier. We do it all at one time, cover the whole city, and it is done.
Mm. I want to back up to that meeting of the Chamber of Commerce, because according to a report in the now-defunct Washington Daily News in July of 1963, the executive committee of the 4,500-member Charlotte Chamber of Commerce met at the urging of Mayor Brookshire. 24 of 39 directors showed up. Three executive committee members had drafted a resolution reading, "We, the directors of the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce, recommend that all businesses in this community catering to the general public be opened immediately to all customers without regard to race, creed, or color. There was a call for discussion. There was none, and the board's approval was unanimous." And when these eat-ins occurred at the behest of Slug Claiborne, there was no protest. How do you explain it? It was completely uneventful. How do you explain this? No one stood up and said, "Not on my watch."
The one of the conditions on which the Chamber of Commerce directors and the restaurant people operated was that there would be a kind of momentary news blackout on that story. It was going to take 2 days, May the 29th and May the 30th, to cover all the restaurants in town. And so they got the Charlotte News and the Charlotte Observer, the Charlotte Post, and the WBT was the only radio television station at the time, mm-hmm. and got them to all agree that there would be no notice of this until after it was over. And so the first story did not occur until May the 31st.
Okay, as a journalist, talk to me about that. is that journalistically proper?
Well, journalistically, it is questionable, but for the good of the community, if you think about, I guess, I'm sure Pete McKnight had a great deal to do with that.
Yeah, could that happen today, do you think?
No, it could not happen today.
Of course not.
Tweeted, you're out there.
And in fact, isn't it true that what happened was, I think, wasn't it two white individuals would take an African-American to lunch in one of these restaurants? And they wouldn't tell anybody where they were going. They would just show up, sit down, and expect to be served, and they were. But when a reporter would show up, they would simply not go to the lunch at that location. They'd go someplace else.
Yeah, a cameraman from WBT showed up at a restaurant, and the black and white diners got up and left. And there was no story. And as soon as the cameraman went away, they went back into the restaurant, sat down, and had lunch.
I'm sure your father participated in this.
No, he did not. He was not invited.
What?
That's important to know. We need to lift Dr. Reginald Hawkins up and celebrate him today because he was not celebrated.
Why was he not invited? Somebody, I think we did a program on this, Willie, you and I, last night on television. And you brought up the fact that this man, Reginald Hawkins, was not embraced by the power structure and did not become a part of the power structure as he would have become today. Why not?
I think that happened in part because he was viewed as being too radical. There were many in the white community who recognized that our community was at a crossroads and we needed to begin to make change as it related to access to public accommodations for all people. And a lot of it had to do with the rate at which that would happen. And Dr. Hawkins had figured that black folk had waited long enough and it needed to happen, and it needed to happen now. I think the whites in the community who were involved in this movement recognized the need for change, but they wanted it to be gradual and without incident. As they looked across the country and saw other communities that were making necessary change, unfortunately that translated into violence. Yeah. And they did not want the violence that was happening there to happen here. And so they put together what was called then the Mayor's Friendly Relations Committee, which was a conduit between government, citizens, and the business community to help guide this effort to integrate this community.
And that's what has now become the Community Relations Committee that you are the executive director of.
Absolutely.
And so today we invite the whole community to join us in the march that 50 years ago Reginald Hawkins led, and join us at 11 o'clock at Johnson C. Smith, where Malcolm Graham will kick us off. Then we'll walk to the square at Trade and Trine. We'll join MECDEC and the May 20th Society and their big MECDEC declaration today and all the festivities. And Attorney Charles Jones will speak and send us off to the courthouse, where we will hear the mayor's proclamation. James Ferguson, who was the lawyer who helped with the was a campaign manager when Hawkins ran for governor, will be speaking, and students of various backgrounds. So people can join us at 11 at Johnson C. Smith, at noon at Trade and Tryon, or at 12:45 at the courthouse, and be part of history, but also be part of the future as we say, what courage do we need today?
And you're going to recreate the Edens later on.
We are. And tonight, Isabel Wilkerson is speaking here at Spirit Square with the May 20th Society. She did Warmth of Other Suns, and it should be an amazing time. But yes, on the 29th, we are all joining forces together, and we are saying we want every congregation, organization, and corporation to be involved with inviting someone of a different ethnicity, a different faith background, or heaven forbid, a different political party, and go to lunch and break down stereotypes, build a relationship, get to know say what is the courage, what are the issues, how do we work together, and then on May 30th, come together as a city at the Levine Museum to have a wonderful From Sit-Ins to Eat-Ins Community Festival, and celebrate the courage 50 years ago and envision the courage we need today. And as you said yesterday, Jack, we're not just talking about the past and how far we've come. We are talking about today and how far we still need to go.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, because it would be nice to sit here and pat ourselves on the back and talk about how the Charlotte way of handling all of this back in 1960-something was highly successful, and we don't have to worry about it anymore. But as the executive director of the Community Relations Committee, you know otherwise.
Well, I think we all have to acknowledge that on the issue of race, as a community, we have come a long way, and there has been tremendous improvements in race relations since the 1960s. However, that does not mean that racism or discrimination has disappeared, that we live in a post-racial Charlotte or post-racial America. I have worked for the Community Relations Committee for 32 years, and what we have found is that racism still exists, but people, it's very subtle, very sophisticated, and people engage in what we call have a nice day racism, or racism with a smile and a pat on the back. And very often the victims of the racism have no idea that they have actually been victimized.
And you've done studies on this.
Yes, we actually we enforce the city and the county's fair housing laws, which prohibit discrimination in housing practices. And we may get a complaint that an apartment complex is discriminating against, say, African Americans. And we'll actually test to see if that is happening. We get two people, give them a script, one black, one white. The script makes them essentially the same person. The only variable is skin color. We'll send the black tester in. He is treated very nicely. However, at the end, he is told, we don't have any vacancies available at this time, but we would love to have you as a tenant, and so we're going to put your name on the waiting list, and as soon as something becomes available, we'll give you a call. As he is leaving, the white tester is coming in. The white tester gets the same treatment, except at the end, the white tester is told, we have vacancies that are immediately available. When would you like to move in?
Now, is this a black-white issue, or is this a white versus every other ethnicity issue?
Mostly it is a black-white issue, but there are cases in which it may happen because of national origin or because of gender.
And you say that some of the things that you have to deal with are fairly scary. I would take it that's not what you're talking about, this apartment renting discrimination, or is it?
Well, actually, it's the fact that it's happening in a way that is scary. The other way that race manifests itself is through something that we call linguistics profiling. Mm-hmm. We actually had a case where an African-American female went by an apartment complex, saw vacancies, called the next day about the vacancies, only to be told that there are no vacancies, and they did not know what she was talking about. So she goes to her white female coworker and she says, call this number and ask about vacancies. The white female calls and is told, yeah, we have vacancies. When would you like to come out and apply? And so she filed a complaint with us, and her allegation was that her voice was recognized as a black voice, and that's why she was told no vacancies. We tested, and surely enough, the black tester was told no vacancies, white tester told vacancies. When we settled the complaint, she got the three-bedroom apartment free of rent for a year and $25,000.
Wow. Wow. Dr. Hawkins declared at this march in 1963, we shall not be pacified with gradualism. We shall not be satisfied with tokenism. We want freedom, and we want it now, which obviously made him a radical. What was your father's reaction to not being invited to participate in these eat-ins?
Well, you have to understand that my father was not in the civil rights movement for self-gratification. His whole being was for human rights for all. And you cannot, and I don't know of any person of faith that ever looked for gratification from the power structure that was oppressing people. Their whole purpose has been to correct those wrongs and to rectify the ills and to get people to understand the word of the Creator. And so be it. If the powers to be at that time did not invite him, there were other things that he could address. The main thing, the key to him, was to make sure that as a result of his toils and his labors and the labors of others around him that would have taken part, as long as there was movement toward inclusion of all, then whether he was there or not, it was a gain, and it was a victory for him.
How far do we have to go, Willie Ratchford? How much farther do we have to go? Let's put it that way.
I think we still have a long ways to go. I think the task has been made a little easier by some of the success that we've had over the past few years. And younger people seem to I don't like saying people are tolerant of race. I think people are just accepting mm-hmm. of race. And younger people are much more accepting of race than our generation. And it will continue to improve.
Willie Ratchford is executive director of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Community Relations Committee. Jack Claiborne, former reporter and editorialist with the Charlotte Observer. Marie Hanlon, executive director of Mecklenburg Ministries. And Reginald Hawkins, Abdullah Salim Jr., the son of Reginald Hawkins, who led that march 50 years ago.